Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. For Pennsylvania deer hunters, the Thanksgiving weekend is a long-standing tradition. It begins with the holiday itself and then traveling to deer camp and opening the firearm season the Monday after Thanksgiving. That traditional timeline could come to an end. The Pennsylvania Game Commission gave preliminary approval yesterday to starting deer season on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. We're joined by Travis Lau, Director of Communications for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Travis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, so what's the idea behind this move?
Well, the idea behind it is to increase the opportunity to participate in the opening day. We hear it all the time, as it is now. A lot of people can't get off work to participate in the opening day, which is has been a Monday opener for, the better part of 60 years now. As we go along, you know, in our neck of the woods, I think that most schools still give the Monday following Thanksgiving off to students, and students who hunt are able to participate in that Monday opener should they have somebody to take them along. But across the state, sure enough, fewer and fewer schools are giving that day off as part of the Thanksgiving vacation. And then you have college students as well. You know, colleges by and large are going to be open that Monday following Thanksgiving. Those college-age hunters who might have the chance to hunt on a Saturday opener might be home with their family and able to hunt the family land or wherever they seek their opportunities close to home on that Saturday are now left out of the mix. So by moving this opening day to the Saturday following Thanksgiving instead of the Monday following Thanksgiving, it would create that opportunity for greater participation on what still is the most magical day in the deer woods in Pennsylvania.
As you mentioned, 60 years, this has been a tradition. And we know that there are many Pennsylvania hunters that don't like to break tradition. What's changed in those 60 years, but especially recently, that you're willing to break that tradition and change it from Monday to Saturday?
Well, we have some experience in changing Monday openers already. It's been probably close to 10 years now that the bear season opener was moved from the Monday before Thanksgiving to the Saturday prior to that. So we've had a Saturday opener for bear for many years. We've seen, as a result of that, record bear license sales nearly every year since. So we have some success there. We have a lot of top 10 bear harvest practically every year during that time. But to cut to the heart of your question, you know, a lot of things have changed for people, and there are a lot of the time constraints that we all seem to find ourselves with this day. Hunting suffers from that. You know, most of the people who at one time bought hunting licenses and since have stopped buying them cite lack of time as their number one reason for lapsing as a hunting license buyer. So to remove some of those obstacles, to provide opportunities on those days of the week where more people might be able to participate, does have the potential to keep those hunters hunting and keep our wildlife management here in Pennsylvania, and in particular our deer management, done for free through deer hunters.
Mm-hmm. So just so everyone knows, the action that was taken by the Game Commission yesterday, that was preliminary approval. What has to happen for this actually to occur?
Well, there's a follow-up meeting in April. It's a two-day meeting. The meeting we just came out of is a three-day meeting. These are our quarterly meetings of the board at which all official action is taken. So on April 9th, the second day of that two-day meeting in April, the board will take up its prepared agenda. It will include the list of seasons and bag limits that was preliminarily approved yesterday. Anything could change on that list, and often it does. So if there was if it was clear in the meantime that the majority of our hunters surely didn't want a Saturday opener, the board wanted to stick with the Monday opener, they could make the change at that time. But regardless of which way they decide to go, we will have a final list of seasons and bag limits April 9th. That will be the final list of seasons and bag limits for the 2019-20 season to begin July 1.
So just to clarify, that if approved by the commission on April 9th, this would take effect this year. The opening of the firearms deer season would be the Saturday after Thanksgiving.
That's correct.
Okay. Another big issue related to this, as you're well aware, Travis, has been hunting on Sunday. I mean, we talked about it a while back on this program, and I know there are many, many hunters and others, non-hunters, who are interested in this issue. Now, Sunday hunting, that would be something that would have to be approved by the legislature.
That's correct, and particularly now with our Board of Game Commissioners, and I believe it's been boards of game commissioners at least two times have issued resolutions in support of Sunday hunting. Our board now all is supportive of Sunday hunting opportunities or the ability for the game commission to regulate Sunday hunting should there be legislative approval of such a bill. But as you point out now, the game commission has no authority to regulate. There's a statutory prohibition on Sunday hunting that dates back eons.
But, okay, so it's not part of what occurred yesterday, had nothing to do with anything, although, from what I understand, the Game Commission is still taking comments on what hunters and non-hunters think about Sunday hunting, correct?
Well, yeah, not to say that we wouldn't accept those comments or compile those comments, but again, the Game Commission has no authority to regulate Sunday hunting. It's out of our hands. There is a private nonprofit called Hunters United for Sunday Hunting. They were here in full force on Sunday at the public comment portion of our meeting, speaking about Sunday hunting opportunities. If there were any listeners out there who were supportive of Sunday hunting and wanted to make their voices heard, I would suggest they contact that group and be pointed in the right direction for how they might be part of a change there.
And also should mention for those who oppose it, obviously that's not the group to contact, but this seems like because it would need legislative action that contacting legislators either for or against would be the way to go.
I would think so too.
Mm-hmm. We know there's been a change in leadership in the Game and Fisheries Committee in the legislature, Senate and House. Has there been any legislation that has been introduced that would allow or remove the prohibition against Sunday hunting?
If it hasn't been introduced, there is one in the works, and that Hunters United group is very hopeful that the bill will go through.
Travis Lau is the Director of Communications for the Pennsylvania Game Commission, so the next step on this comes April 9th when the Game Commission has its final vote on starting the firearm deer season the Saturday after Thanksgiving as opposed to the Monday. Travis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, no problem, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The time after the Civil War is called the Reconstruction Period, and it generally is thought to be from 1865 to 1877. It's a period that doesn't get much attention in the history books, but yet it's a time when decisions were made that still are being felt today. Many of those decisions didn't have a positive impact. Our guest today has written a book that examines the Reconstruction Period. Dr. Alan Gelzo is author of the new book, Reconstruction, A Concise History. Dr. Gelzo is the Henry R. Luce Professor of Civil War Era and Director of Civil War Era Studies Program at Gettysburg College. Dr. Gelzo, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure once again to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Gelzo, you have called, and you say this right in the introduction of the book, that Reconstruction is the ugly duckling of American history. Why?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One is, it's a series of missed opportunities to bring the Civil War to a positive conclusion. If we understand that the Civil War was intended to realize two great objectives, one was the abolition of slavery and the raising of the freed slaves to full citizenship in the American Republic, and the other was the reintegration of the secessionist states into the Union, then we have to say that Reconstruction really only achieved 50% of its objectives, and even that 50% had some serious flaws in it. Partly, I think this is because a lot of the people who were the architects of Reconstruction had only the dimmest idea of what they were doing when they encountered the problem of Reconstruction. And here they had the Civil War, and wars can look very direct. You either win them or you lose them. But what do you do after? How do you, so to speak, clean up the mess? And how do you make things work peaceably afterwards? That was a question that never really seemed to have occurred to too many people in leadership positions. And unfortunately, it showed in the frequently ham-handed way that Reconstruction was handled both North and South.
When you call it a lost opportunity and you say that achieved only a half of it, that lost opportunity, erasing slavery and racial inequities, what could they have done better? And I know this is a broad question, but what could the leaders at the time have done differently?
Well, one thing they could have done differently was to have taken more seriously how very stubborn the resistance was going to be to integrating the freed slaves into the political life of the southern states and of the nation as a whole. That they simply underestimated in the most colossal fashion imaginable. And for that reason, they failed to take the steps that were going to be necessary to make it happen. They failed to take steps along the lines of political education. They failed to take steps along the lines of protection for the freed slaves. I mean, put yourself in the position of the newly freed slaves. You now have freedom. All right, fine. What exactly does that get you? Well, it may get you the opportunity to choose to do things, but there are also lots of people around you, former slave owners, ex-Confederate soldiers, who are going to do the very best they can to constrict the opportunities that you have. So you have freedom, but once you begin to find out that this freedom can frequently become very, very narrow, depending on the people who are trying to put boundaries around it. Then, on top of that, there's inexperience in terms of political organization. I mean, slaves had been slaves. No one had ever invited them into political organization or political life. And then suddenly the expectation is, well, you really should now plunge right into the civic life of the country. Well, what was that civic life if all you had known was life on the plantation, a life of oppression, a life of degradation? That was not going to be learned very easily. And then the greatest lessons were going to have to be learned by the former slave owners themselves, who frequently assumed at the end of the war that while slavery was going to be gone, their dominance over black people was going to stay. To have restrained the kind of laws that were passed that tried to return the former slaves to virtual peonage would have required a serious commitment on the part of the federal government, especially in the form of military occupation in the Confederacy, that really would have needed to have lasted an entire political generation before all the vestiges of the slave-owning aristocracy had finally been erased from Southern life. All the habits, all the small-scale ways of humiliating, of confining, and of oppressing people, that would have required the emergence of a generation that had been schooled in an entirely different way of looking at American life and life in the States. And that simply didn't happen, in large measure because, A, nobody really knew to plan for it, and B, Americans are really not terribly good at carrying off reconstructions. We didn't do it very well at the end of the First World War. We, to put it mildly, we skedaddled out of Europe at the end of the First World War, And the result of that kind of abrupt withdrawal is all too manifest in what happened in Germany from the 1920s into the 1930s. It's also come closer to us in more recent times as we've seen what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've been very, very quick to declare mission accomplished, only to realize afterwards that the mission really hasn't been accomplished, and that the work of reconstruction requires a great deal more in the way of the commitment of money, of military occupation, of rebuilding and reconstruction and re-educating an entire society, and this is what they call regime change, than had been anticipated. In one respect, looking at how poorly we fared in doing this in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's really not much of a surprise that 150 years ago we did just as badly. The wonder is that we didn't do much worse.
At the end of the Civil War and during the Reconstruction period, there was a real concern politically in the newly conquered South. One was that freed slaves would now be counted as whole persons rather than three-fifths of a person, as had been the law before. That would give the South a bigger population and possibly more members of Congress, hence making them stronger politically in Washington than what they were before the war. Talk about that a little bit.
This is one of the unlooked-for pieces of fallout in the politics of the Civil War. Because understand that before the Civil War, the Southern states had only been permitted to count three-fifths of their African-American populations towards representation in the House of Representatives. Now, that infamous three-fifths clause is sometimes looked upon as being a kind of racial opprobrium, that blacks were regarded as being only three-fifths of a human being. The actual political situation pointed in a somewhat different direction. Three-fifths was a restriction on white Southerners. The three-fifths was there because white Southerners had wanted to count their slaves as five-fifths towards representation, thus gaining extra representatives in the House of Representatives. And the Constitution only permitted them to count three-fifths, so that was actually something that white Southerners lost on. Northerners, of course, would have liked to have counted no fifths of slaves, because slaves as slaves really didn't participate in the political process. If they didn't participate in the political process, why should they be counted as all towards representation? Mm. But three-fifths was the compromise. Now, with the ending of slavery in 1865, suddenly African Americans are going to be counted as five-fifths. They're not slaves anymore. And yet, they have not a single one of the political and civil rights that would lead them to direct political participation in the political life of the Southern states. That meant that the Southerners could send back on the votes of the same white people who had voted representatives to Congress before the Civil War. Those same people could then send back not only the same representatives they'd sent before, but an extra 13 or 14 Southern Democratic representatives to Congress, who would then link arms with the Northern Democratic wing of the party. A Northern Democratic wing, which, although it had lost two elections in 1860 and in 1864, was still a potent force to reckon with. Let that link up, and suddenly you might find the first Congress to assemble after the end of the Civil War in December of 1865, overrun with new Southern representatives, overrun with a fresh Democratic majority, which could then repeal all the legislation that had been passed during the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party, repeal the tariffs, repeal the Pacific Railroad Bill, repeal the National Banking Act, perhaps even, and this is the most dismaying thing of all, perhaps even vote to assume the Confederate war debt. In other words, to make Northern taxpayers pay the debts run up by the Confederate government during its rebellion. When you looked at that, suddenly you realized that the 13th Amendment, freeing the slaves, great idea. Suddenly you realize, oops, that's not enough. We have to take another step. That is what leads Republicans in Congress, first of all, to take measures to exclude these newly elected Southerners coming from the Southern states, but then also to move towards the 14th Amendment, which will extend civil rights, all the privileges and immunities, to the newly freed slaves, regardless of color or previous condition of servitude. But you know something, Scott? Even then, the 14th Amendment doesn't plug all the gaps in the dike. And suddenly people realize, all right, yes, civil rights, but Southerners in those states will exclude voting rights from civil rights. Oops, we have to pass another amendment, and that becomes the 15th Amendment in 1869. See, what you're looking at in Reconstruction is, in many cases, a long case of improvisation. Again, people did not have a template whereby they said, okay, here's what you do at step A of Reconstruction, here's what you do at step B and step C. They were constantly trying to deal with situations and then finding those situations generated new problems and then having to create a solution for those new problems and so on and so forth. And that's what gives us what's called the three Reconstruction Amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th. In the process, you expend a lot of time, you expend a lot of political capital, and by the time you get into the 1870s, a good deal of this is not working.
With all that said, as far as looking at how much political power the South would have after the Civil War, there were laws set as to who could serve in the governments from the Southern states. Former Confederate officials were not legally allowed to serve, but President Andrew Johnson, who became president after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, approved a lot of pardons. And when I say a lot, more than 11,000 pardons, which kind of made those laws very, very ineffective.
Andrew Johnson really becomes the linchpin on which so much of the tragedies of Reconstruction turn. Because Andrew Johnson, for one thing, was never intended by anybody to be the President of the United States. He had been tacked on to Lincoln's reelection campaign in 1864 because he was a Unionist Democrat from Tennessee, and recruiting Johnson to serve as Lincoln's vice president was a way the Republicans had of saying to Democrats, whom they needed to bring into their wartime coalition, we're not hostile to you, we're broadly based, we Republicans are a big tent, we'll bring in anyone who is willing to work for the preservation of the Union. And so Johnson is taken on as Lincoln's vice president. Big mistake. After Lincoln's death, it very quickly becomes apparent that Johnson is definitely no Lincoln. To the contrary, he is a man of Southern instincts. He has no sympathy for the freed slaves whatsoever. He considers that whatever governments are going to be created in the Southern states are going to be white men's governments. And he's not shy about saying that. In a series of proclamations that he begins to issue just 6 weeks after he assumes office, he basically says to the defeated Confederate states, I'm going to appoint provisional governors for you, provisional governors whom you will like, and you set about reconstructing your states with new state constitutions that will abolish slavery. Once you've done that, you're on your own. You can create anything you like. And they take that as the signal that once they've gotten rid of slavery, they can simply replace it with all kinds of debt peonage, economic restrictions, vagrancy laws, what are called black codes, which restrict the newly freed slaves even from owning knives or speaking disrespectfully. Speak disrespectfully to a white man, you could find yourself arrested, put in prison, and then auctioned off for a year to a likely white man who will stand up and purchase your time. Well, that's slavery in everything but name. And that was exactly what white Southerners at the end of the Civil War hoped they could do. They had lost the war. They had had the stuffing beaten out of them militarily. But they still hoped, because of the example that Johnson offered to them, that somehow they could get away with recreating as much as possible of the old slave South. And Johnson turned a blind eye in many respects to what they were doing. This is what horrified Lincoln's Republicans in Congress. This is why they would, under no circumstances, agree to the seating of representatives elected by these Johnson regimes in the South, and it's why they turned first to the amendments and then to a series of Reconstruction Acts, which would return the Southern states to military control so that under that military control, real state constitutions could be written and real regimes put in place in the Southern states that would actively involve Unionist white people and the freed slaves.
It's something you write in the book that is fascinating. Many people probably, you know, it's different times, 150 years ago, that the South didn't understand free labor. In fact, they thought that work was ungentlemanly.
Well, consider what the plantation system was like. Here are white slave owners. They are people who own the people who do the actual work by hand. So if you had a living that you did by hand, that was somehow slave work. Cotton was picked by hand. Other agricultural goods, they were all done by the hands of slave laborers. That kind of identification of work with your hands as being something that belonged to slaves was stigmatized free labor throughout the South and made it clear that the only kind of behavior that was really to be accorded gentlemanly status was sitting on the porch sipping a mint julep. Abraham Lincoln complained about this bitterly in the 1850s when he said that if you come from the South, if a young man comes from the South, he wants to make sure that he has a slave treading on his heels because that shows that he is a gentleman of leisure and doesn't work with his hands. And that is supposed to make him socially superior to not just slaves, but to any white people who work with their hands. Well, Abraham Lincoln, of course, had come up the hard way working with his hands. Into his hands, an axe had been put when he was 12 years old, and he used what he called that useful instrument well up until he was 21. Lincoln rankled at that arrogance. But in the South, the idea was that free labor was not really something that ennobled people. And after the Civil War, when Northern missionaries came south, hoping to rejuvenate the Southern economy, hoping to move it away from the plantation system and more towards small-scale manufacturing, shops, commerce, and trade, Southerners crinkled up, white Southerners crinkled up their noses at this. They thought that it was detestable, and they did their very best to discourage these Northerners who wanted to bring the gospel of free labor into the South. It turned out, in fact, not to be too difficult to discourage them, and after several years, many of these Northern enterprises and entrepreneurs finally gave up and went back north.
We only have about 90 seconds left, Dr. Gelzo. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You write in the book that there are four successes of Reconstruction. What are they?
Well, one success, at least, is this, that the country did get reunited politically. We were one nation once again, and we did not do, as sometimes civil wars do, we did not lapse again into recurrent civil conflict and civil wars. Another was that at least we got on the books the 14th and the 15th Amendments, and although these were only half-heartedly enforced in the 1870s and the 1880s, nevertheless, they pointed in the direction, they created the seedbed for the civil rights movement of the 1950s. There was always that hope that the situation that had been created by the overthrow of Reconstruction could, in fact, be turned around. We also managed to do this without necessarily creating reigns of terror. Now, what I mean by that are the kinds of reigns of terror that conquering nations impose upon defeated nations. We, in a sense, restrained ourselves. Walt Whitman said that Reconstruction has been paralleled nowhere in the world, in any other country on the globe. The whole batch of the Confederate leaders would have had their heads cut off. We didn't do that. We exercised a measure of self-restraint. Now, the problem was we paid for that self-restraint by the fact that the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacists were the ones who imposed that kind of thing.
I'm going to have to interrupt. Dr. Alan Gelzo, author of the new book, Reconstruction, A Concise History. As always, Dr. Gelzo, a pleasure having a conversation with you today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we talk about women in science, technology, basically the STEM topics. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. The U.S. Army Education and Heritage Center in Carlisle often stages events that involve living history, and many times reenactors are part of those events. A week from Saturday, AHEC has its eighth annual Reenactor Recruitment Day, and it's a great opportunity to learn about history. Joining us to tell us more about it is Carl Warner, an educator at the U.S. Army Education and Heritage Center. Mr. Warner, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
How would you describe Reenactor Recruitment Day?
Well, I got to tell you, it's one of the best programs we have each year, with over 250 reenactors that we bring in. And it's nice. It's inside, so you're out of the cold. It's a great opportunity for those reenactors to shake out all their gear for the season coming up with all the reenacting going on all over the region. But it also is an education program. You know, you get to go in and see multiple different types of reenactors and living historians representing U.S. Army history and even other military history from all different eras. I mean, our earliest group this year is pikemen from the 1600s,
wow.
Massachusetts Bay Colony sort of stuff. And that goes all the way through. I think we've even got a medic from Desert Storm coming in this year.
Mm. So when you say that it is living history, and anyone who has attended or pay attention to what you do at AHEC, there is a lot of programs that involve living history and reenactors, but it's called Reenactor Recruitment Day. Are you recruiting reenactors?
Well, sure. So that's part of it. You know, these reenactors, when they come in, these living historians, it's interesting. When you go to a reenactment, they're off in a field or they're in a camp and they're in character. And sometimes you don't get an opportunity to go up and actually talk to them about the history they're representing. So Reenactor Recruitment Day, they're behind a booth. They're not in character, but they are dressed up in their impressions. So you can actually go in and chat with them about reenacting, about living history, about the ins and outs and geekiness of what the specific parts of history that they're representing. But then they also have the opportunity to cross-pollinate between groups. You know, there are a lot of reenactors like to have more than one impression. And then they also have the opportunity to recruit from any of the folks coming through, the visitors coming through that might be interested in getting started. A lot of those groups have, programs within their organization to help new reenactors get started. So it's as much of an edge program as it is a reenactor recruitment, like you said.
So bottom line, even if someone was not interested in becoming a reenactor themselves, although they could do that.
Sure.
That there's a lot of living history there. There's a lot they can learn.
Oh, absolutely. You can get in there and really talk about, get down into the nitty-gritty of the history that each of these folks are representing.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you don't have any desire to go out and tramp around in the field and do reenactments, we'd love to have you come out and just learn the history. And that's what these people are really passionate about is their era, their piece of history, and they'll talk to you about it.
You mentioned that you go back even to the 1600s. I understand that there are even enemy combatants.
Oh, sure. So we have folks representing all different eras of Army history, and that is our major theme is Army history. We have allies and enemies as well. So we'll have several different World War I German troops. We have a few different World War II German troops. We even have a group this year of Cold War Soviet era troops coming in. But at the same time, you can also see, we've got a guy that does, the passenger pigeons and signal sort of stuff for the Canadian Army in World War I. We also have, other Canadian units and French units from World War II. So you get to see not just U.S. Army history, Civil War, World War I, World War II, Desert Storm, Korea, Vietnam. You also get to see some impressions of things you might not see at a normal reenactment.
Why does someone become a reenactor?
Well, usually it's passion. You know, you can only learn so much from books. It's when you get the equipment in your hands and you're out there in the field, you're out there with your friends, and you really get to experience it as close as you can to what the original soldiers, and in this case, soldiers, experienced. There are no other opportunities to get that close to it. And you end up learning a lot of things that you just can't learn from a book.
Like what, for example?
Well, how cold is it? Yeah. You can read how cold it was in a particular in a particular episode, but until you're out in the snow camping or doing a reenactment out in the snow, you don't know just how cold it really is. Same thing with the weapons. You know, you can, for example, in the American Revolution and later on with muskets, you know, loaded nine times. Well, what does that mean? Well, when you're a reenactor, you actually have that weapon in your hand, and you can learn how to load in nine times. It's experiential education at its finest.
Isn't it expensive, though?
It can be. It depends on how far you want to go. Like I said, a lot of the reenactors that I know personally have setups that they help brand new reenactors with, you know, extra equipment, things that they can use before they really have to commit financially. And then there's, of course, just like anything else that you're going to buy when you get into a hobby, there's the lower-end version, there's the higher-end version, there's the custom stuff and the stuff that comes out of a factory. It just depends on how much you want to go into it. But if you do get bitten by the bug, it is quite a hobby for sure.
My sense is that most reenactors want to be authentic as possible. So when you talk high-end, low-end, then I imagine high-end is more authentic than low-end.
Well, yeah, and of course that's part of the culture of living history and reenacting is the different views on how close to reality you really have to get. And that's one of the beauties of it. You know, you learn more about the history itself when you get into those details. That you just can't get from books or television shows or something like that.
I read an article last summer that said that there's been a decline in the number of Civil War reenactors. Gettysburg being here in central Pennsylvania and as close as this part of the country was to where many of the major battles were fought, we probably see more Civil War reenactors than from any other
sure.
period in this area of the state. I mean, is that true? Are they in decline and why?
Well, it's tough to tell on that. So, are they in decline? Probably yes. Living history, impressions, and reenacting in general—it ebbs and flows. You know, you have, for example, 75th anniversary of World War II coming up. You have the 50th anniversary of Vietnam, so we're starting to see a little bit of an uptick in World War II and Vietnam reenactors. The 150th of the Civil War, it was a few years ago, and we saw more then. You also have a lot of reenactors that switch. You know, they have multiple impressions. The real trick is getting those younger audiences more exposure to the actual living history. If the younger audiences don't have that exposure, if they're not coming out to events like Reenactor Recruitment Day and various reenactments, they just don't know about it. So it's radio shows like this, it's advertisements to come out to places like the AHEC that expose that next generation. And that's how we're going to get the numbers back up for the living history and that source of education.
See, and something you did, I was just thinking about this as we're describing it, is that very often students today, we've heard the complaints from students that they don't like memorizing dates when it comes to history, that they don't feel it's relevant. But actually seeing someone dressed in period piece who can talk to a student, that would seem to be a great way for young people to learn about history.
Oh, absolutely. It's about the experience of, in our case at AHEC, it's all about the soldier. It's all about the U.S. Army soldier. But reenacting is so much more than just that, too. You can find a date and a time and a place on the internet. You know, it takes 30 seconds. If you really want to figure out what it was like, you've got, you know, living history is one of the best ways to go about experiencing that.
So recruitment day is next Saturday, February 9th. Tell us a little bit about it.
So we'll be opening the doors to the public at 10 o'clock. We'll close the doors at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You come on in, and there's going to be over 250 reenactors, 58 different reenacting and living history organizations. It's not just necessarily military history, straight guns and ammunition. We've got a group of, medics from Desert Storm. We have a group of dancers that do Victorian era, Civil War style ball dancing. Frontier recreation from the American Revolution. Communication specialists, and of course the folks that supported soldiers, Civil War women's groups, things like that, spouses groups. So you get the whole gambit of living history by coming in.
Carl Warner is an educator at the U.S. Army Education and Heritage Center in Carlisle. Mr. Warner, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks a lot.
And you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. By the way, if you missed today's program or any program, any Smart Talk program from the past, they are posted online at WITF.org/smarttalk. Also, the program airs tonight at 7 o'clock, airs every night at 7 o'clock. I hear from so many people say, oh, I hear you in the car when I'm out at night between 7 and 8. So just want to remind everyone of that in case you do miss the program between 9 and 10 in the morning. Moving on, the Bethesda Mission in Harrisburg recently launched the I Heart Harrisburg campaign, a partnership with 14 local coffee shops. Their goal is to build greater community pride, bolster local business, and raise awareness for a new community center on Hearst Street in Harrisburg. Coffee shop patrons will receive an I Heart Harrisburg cup sleeve when they purchase a cup of coffee at the participating businesses. Appearing on Smart Talk today to discuss the initiative is Katie Andriano, who is the communications manager with Bethesda Mission, and Rick Hawtrey, owner of Capital Joe, with locations in both Harrisburg and Mechanicsburg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So what makes this, and am I pronouncing, is this how you refer to it? Because I know you have a hashtag, IHeartHBG. How do you refer to it?
We are calling it IHeartHarrisburg.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So how would you describe this program?
Well, we wanted to create a way to start off the new year on a positive note, to share some love for the Harrisburg community with various people. So it seemed like a good idea to partner with the local small business community, particularly coffee shops, where a lot of people spend a lot of time, especially when you need a hot drink. But then also because coffee shops have become kind of a community centers all to their own. People like to meet there and discuss friend-related things and community events. So it seemed like a natural partnership to spread the word about our community center.
Mm-hmm. So when you say spread the word about your community center, what in particular are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've operated a youth center on Hearst Street in Harrisburg for almost 30 years now. And it's been... We see it as our preventative care unit. So if people aren't familiar with Bethesda Mission, Bethesda is Harrisburg's local rescue mission. So there are similar organizations to us throughout the country in pretty much every city. But what you classically think of is a homeless shelter, which is super important, especially this time of year in the cold
especially
weather.
Especially a day like today. Yeah.
Exactly. But what we've been able to do throughout the over 100 years of existence is adapt to the needs of the community around us. So we're not just a homeless shelter anymore. While we have homeless shelter and recovery programs for men, we also have that for women. And then we've begun the Youth Center Initiative, which we're trying to expand to reach more people as a community center, reaching children, teens, and families in a preventative way. We've found that if we can invest in those communities, in those kids, and those families, then they're not going to be our shelter guests down the road. And that's what we want to see.
You said that when many people think of a rescue mission like a Bethesda Mission, that they think of a homeless shelter. They also probably think about homeless people coming in to get a meal. Unfortunately, there are many times where I get the sense that the public only thinks about it certain times of year, days like today where it's very cold, holidays, that it's something that the public needs to think about a little bit more. And just talking about what else Bethesda Mission is doing helps to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're a 365-day, 24-hour facility. We haven't, just at the homeless shelters, we haven't had an empty bed in 6 years, winter alone. that's throughout the year. We run over capacity. But of course, on days like this, it's even more. But at the same time, the busiest time of year for our community center is the summer, because we're hosting summer programs for kids who are out of school, investing in mentorship relationships and trying to just help them create a better vision for their future.
Mm-hmm. So what you're doing with the partnership with the coffee shops, in a lot of ways, I mean, there are obviously positive aspects to it all around, but it's a fundraising activity.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're embarking on a construction project, which it started this past summer. And the total, it's a $2.4 million project to triple the size of our community center. We are just under $350,000 short of completing the project. So this is a way that we're trying to get the word out. There are collection jars at all of the coffee shops as well, so people can drop a few dollars in to support the project, and then hopefully visit our website, BethesdaMission.org, to learn even more and become even more interested.
Rick Hawtrey is the owner of Capital Joe, has locations in both Harrisburg and Mechanicsburg. So Rick, why did Capital Joe get involved in this project?
Well, thank you for asking. We love Bethesda Mission. We love what they do. It's so important. I have a friend of mine, a naval captain, who took his team to the mission last week, and he was telling me just about the great experience they had. You know, I know we'll never run short of people who need help, whether we're talking youth-age people in preventative situations or those who are just not in a good place right now. What we do run short of is people who care, and we love Bethesda Mission and what they do. I know that as a business, and also active in my church, we don't really have the skills and resources to help them directly. So we support Bethesda Mission however we can financially and spreading the word, because they care about people. And at Capital Joe, that's what we're about. Our mission is good drinks to make people happy. It's about the experience with our customers, and what I try to teach my staff. Being in line with Bethesda Mission, caring about people. Customer service isn't about just knowing what a person wants and trying to fill a need. It's about deeply caring about people and trying to create something for them. And you know, Bethesda Mission, they're taking someone out of a horrible situation like today when it's freezing, giving them a bed and a meal. You know, for us, we have someone who's working and they're having a bad day, and they come and they get that cup of coffee or that latte. And they take that first drink, and the joy and the euphoria that they feel should be something special for them. It's about creating an experience. That's what we try to create. We care about people, and we express our care through giving you a moment of reprieve from your day, where Bethesda Mission is giving people a moment of reprieve from potentially a horrible situation. So we love them. We support them.
How have your customers accepted this? I mean, have they been willing participants?
Oh yeah. So we have the jar, and we had been setting the jar right next to our tip jar, and we felt in the last 2 years, and we noticed some people would put in both, some people would try to pick and choose, but this year we decided to move the jar to a more prominent spot, and I watch customers who they're there, they're waiting for their coffee, they see it, they actually read what's on the jar now. They don't assume it's a bigger tip jar. They read it, and I see larger bills going in. Oh. And I love it.
I want to thank both of you for being with us. So let me just, Katie, ask you in the minute or so we have left, some details if our listeners are interested. Obviously, you'd like them to patronize the coffee shops. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Sure. I would love for them to visit our website, BethesdaMission.org, just to read the whole story behind the community center and get the background on that. And we also really encourage people to come for tours. You can hear all about it. You can read about it, but you don't really get the feel for it until you visit it. And that's available for any of our facilities. Please come visit us and come for a tour.
Do you need volunteers?
Absolutely. Yes.
To do what?
Yeah, we always have volunteers serving food and helping at the shelters, but at the community center in particular, it's going to expand even more needed volunteers to help run programs, to keep the place running and mentor kids.
Katie Adriano is the communications manager at Bethesda Mission. Rick Hawtrey, owner of Capital Joe, locations in Harrisburg and Mechanicsburg. Thank you very much for being with us today and for what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about women, girls, younger women in the STEM fields, whether it's in school or in careers that involve the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.